Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 8th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, resuscitating vulture populations in India, China's focus on climate change, and new insight into how bacteria help mercury accumulate in the environment.
It has been known for about 40 years that bacteria are responsible for transforming mercury into methyl mercury, but researchers have been unable to figure it out.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Inorganic mercury metal, or HG, is a known toxin, which is why mercury thermometers are being phased out and even banned in some parts of the world. But the most toxic mercury species is methylmercury, or CH3HG, and it's this form that builds up in the food chain. How mercury is methylated in the environment is the subject of a report this week, and senior author Liyuan Liang spoke with me about the role of anaerobic bacteria in this chemical pathway.
Globally, mercury is a priority contaminant. It's a neurotoxin that biomagnifies along aquatic food chains under its methylated form. Now, it has been known for about 40 years that bacteria are responsible for transforming mercury into methylmercury in a process known as methylation, but researchers have been unable to figure it out. So we ask ourselves, what might make methylmercury on a molecular level? What is the biochemistry that might be involved? So we look at the chemistry of mercury methylation. There is a large scientific literature dating back to the 60s and 70s, and it came up with ideas about what we expect to be needed to transfer a methyl group to mercury. Mm-hmm. The key to the discovery is we knew that a carotenoid or cobalamin-dependent protein had been shown to be involved in the process. So we searched for such a protein encoded in the genome of known methylating bacteria, and we found the genes.
So methylmercury is a mercury species that commonly builds up within the food chain. It's what we sometimes find in things like canned tuna. How does this mercury get from its inorganic metallic state into this other species with a methyl group attached?
So when mercury is emitted into the environment, it undergoes all sorts of cycling. So it's deposited and then it's oxidized to mercury 2+. And so although we have some ideas about the biochemical reactions, we still don't know the details of the methylation mechanisms. We are sitting on a Superfund site. We do have local mercury contamination, and the site has been trying to reduce the amount of mercury released into the creek, but we didn't see methylmercury reducing in fish tissues, so there's not a direct correlation between inorganic mercury and methylmercury. So that's why we study this and trying to see, you know, in what way we can really help to clean up the environment.
So you had an idea for a kind of protein you were looking for, a carotenoid protein, as you said. How did you search for that within these bacteria?
So we had the genomes available, and we actually did for a time try to compare the methylators with non-methylators to see what jumps out, so to speak. And It didn't really give us conclusive results. It showed us a list of targets. So what really brought this discovery is the chemistry principle. And we went back to think about what the chemistry required to do the work. And then linking the chemistry and genomes, we were able to make the discovery.
And this discovery was a pair of genes that appear to be involved in this methylation pathway.
That's right. So two genes are necessary for methylation. One, we call it HGCA. So it encodes a carotenoid protein. Mm-hmm. And the other gene, we call it HGCB, and that encodes a ferredoxin-like protein. So one protein transfers the methyl group to mercury, and the other protein seems to help to convert the cofactor cobalt back to the right oxidation state for the cycle to go around again.
And how did you determine that, yes, these two specific genes are involved in this one very specific pathway?
We found these genes all occur in the non-methylators, and they are absent in the confirmed non-methylators. So that's a clue. And the genes seem to do the right chemistry. So I thought we should delete these genes from the bacteria and see whether the bacteria will lose the methylation activity. Indeed, it lost the methylation activity. And then we reintroduce these genes into the mutant strains. And by doing that, it restored their ability to methylate mercury.
Wow.
That's confirmed the discovery.
One thing that you note in your paper is that this methylation pathway is really similar from one methylating species to another. So that, you know, all the bacteria that you found that methylate mercury, they all do it basically the same way using these two genes. Was it surprising to you that this motif appears to be so invariable?
It is a big surprise. The methylating bacteria are phylogenetically diverse, and these two genes are conserved only among the methylators across the bacteria and archaea. So we have sulfate reducers, iron reducers, Clostridia, syntrophs, and methanogens. And up to this point, the confirmed methylators has been only sulfate reducers and iron reducers. So now we were able to also look at the other bacteria. And there are many, many strains that are closely related. But of course, we still don't know their native functions. That's another mystery and require further investigation.
And by native functions, you mean why those genes appeared in the first place?
Yeah, because there's no advantage to methylate mercury. Oh, we don't know why they methylate mercury.
And why do you think this pathway would be so well conserved among different species of bacteria?
Well, if you look at the database, there are more than maybe 7,000, maybe even more sequenced bacteria. We only found 52 up to today, and there might be more we'll find. So in a way, they're not that many. So that's a little bit curious. So we don't really know the evolutionary significance, and there are lots of unanswered questions at this point.
So what do you see as the broader implications of this work? Is there a path from this kind of study to the greater field of studying mercury in the environment?
So this work solves a 40-year-old question, how this toxin is produced in the environment. So we should be able to develop methods to detect methylating bacteria in the environment and perhaps in clinical samples and determine the condition that favor methylation in the environment. This work also, I want to emphasize, draws expertise from many fields, including chemistry, bioinformatics, biochemistry, and bacterial genetics. And really will have major implications in the development of bioremediation and conservation strategies. So not only this study fill one of the gaps in our fundamental knowledge on mercury methylation, but the findings of this research also pave the way for very practical applications, such as design of primers and probes, assessing the presence and quantifying the extent of methylation in the environment. Basically, I think with the genetic information, we can detect methylation potential more rapidly and with specificity, and will contribute monitoring the efficiency of any mitigation strategy in the future. Lots of work need to be done, but it really opens up lots of possibilities.
Great. Well, Liyuan Liang, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Liyuan Liang and colleagues write about mercury methylating bacteria online this week. You can read the report at www.scienceexpress.org.
Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible.com, and we wanted to let you know about a special offer. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
So in case you're having difficulty deciding, we figured we'd give you a few recommendations to go with the themes of today's show. Since my interview a little bit later is about climate change, I went with Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming by Chris Mooney. How about you, Sarah?
Well, Carrie, I found a brand new book that I have not yet read, but I want to. It's Brian Hare's new audiobook, The Genius of Dogs, his work in evolutionary biology and citizen science around dog socialization was featured in a News Focus in Science last week.
Very cool. So check out these books and more from Audible, and don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
If you pull one thread, the web shakes. In both spider homes and more metaphorical webs, you can't always see what the outcome might be of a small change. For example, after going off patent or becoming available for mass production, a veterinary drug becomes a common treatment of pain in Indian cows. When they die, the cows are now adulterated vulture food. The vultures can't handle even tiny doses of the drug and begin to die off. The consequences to human health and ecology are widespread and damaging. I spoke with Andrew Bomford about the first hints of success for bringing these birds back from the brink.
I'm a conservation scientist interested in lots of different topics, but over the last few years have become increasingly interested in trying to understand when conservation can succeed and circumstances under which it can't, but when it succeeds, how it can succeed. And so I've recently been putting together a catalogue of success stories in conservation from around the world, and that brought me in to understand a bit more about the vulture problem in South Asia. The time I wrote the book, which is called Wild Hope, came out late last year, the vulture problem hadn't yet begun to turn a corner, and that's really been documented much more recently. But that meant I was interested, and all the more interested, when the good news began to emerge.
Mm-hmm. So your perspective for science is called pollution, politics, and vultures. Let's start with the pollution problem. 20 years ago, vultures were dying off in South Asia. What was actually going on?
Well, what was happening was a very effective painkiller developed for humans, something called diclofenac, had come out of patent, and the Indian pharmaceutical industry saw a market there for its application in cattle. There's a big market here because cows are sacred in India. They can't be killed. Even vets aren't allowed to kill off dying cattle. So painkillers, palliative care of sick animals, are very popular. The problem, though, is that vultures are unusually sensitive to diclofenac. It induces kidney failure in them, kills them very quickly. One recently dead cow, the diclofenac that's in its tissues would kill any vulture that fed on it within a day or two. And the problem is that cows aren't eaten by people in India for religious reasons, so they've mostly historically been left out in the countryside for vultures to feed on. So there were lots of vultures feeding on these cows, and as a consequence, lots of vultures dying. This, in due course, caused dramatic decline in several species of vultures. Three of them, one of which had been amongst the most abundant birds of prey in the world, collapsed so quickly, 99% of the population was lost over the course of about 20 years. Three species became critically endangered. That's to say, scientists consider that there's a very significant risk of them going extinct in the near future. That's a problem for biodiversity, but also a major problem for people, because vultures have been providing the free service of disposing of these carcasses. Right. In their absence, there was a dramatic buildup of cattle carcasses, serious worries about the spread of disease, both directly from the carcasses and also from the rising numbers of feral dogs and rats.
Oh.
Even a schism among the Parsi religion over how to dispose of their dead, now that they could no longer leave their bodies out to be picked clean by vultures in their traditional towers of silence.
And that's actual human corpses, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay, well, so this sounds pretty dire. Loss of a lot of vultures and some health problems running rampant for humans. So now that they had figured out what was going on, it became a political problem. This is actually happening in more than one country, and, you know, it's involving the availability of drugs. So what kind of response was there on the political level?
So initially, there was disbelief from quite a lot of the pharmaceutical industry and from some vets that the diclofenac, which is beneficial in many mammals, could be causing a problem in these birds.
Mm-hmm.
But the scientific case was by now pretty compelling. Governments listened to it, in part because a lot of national and international conservation NGOs got together, conducted the right research, paid for it to be published and got out as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And in due course, as a result of that pressure and the clarity of the evidence, governments collectively banned the use of diclofenac in 2006 for veterinary purposes. They took about 2 years from the first robust evidence to the ban by politicians.
And what countries was that in?
So that was first in India, Pakistan, and Nepal, and then 4 years later, Bangladesh followed suit.
So as you point out in your article, agreeing to the ban did not actually stop the use of this veterinary drug. There are more steps that need to be taken.
Yes. So one of the key follow-ups was then widespread awareness raising of people in the pharmaceutical industry, vets, and the public as a whole. That was crucial and is still very important. Alongside that, there was research, again, paid for by the conservation NGOs, not industry or government, to find a safe alternative to diclofenac, which was something called meloxicam, which was in due course then tested on South African vultures, a non-threatened but related species, and found to be safe. Mm-hmm. Then alongside that, there's been continued monitoring of cattle carcasses to check to see what was happening to diclofenac and related drug levels in those carcasses, see whether the ban was working, and to see whether these other alternatives were being used. There was testing of purchases from pharmacies to see what they were offering for sale and to look for illegal sales. There was widespread testing of problems that farmers faced in terms of switching from diclofenac to meloxicam. What were the barriers that were preventing them from making that switch? And then on top of that, there's been the development of so-called vulture-safe zones in several of these countries where there is provision of safe meat, which is guaranteed diclofenac-free at vulture restaurants, and development of backup populations through captive breeding in these countries as well.
What's a vulture restaurant?
It's where you put out meat in a particular spot that the vultures get to know about that will draw in birds from quite a wide area. And in the case of the program in Nepal, that's been coupled with a development program. So these are run by villages who can charge tourists for coming to see vultures, which are now increasingly rare. And as a consequence, there's some money going into local development as well as helping vultures.
Wow. So with
a smart idea.
Yeah, definitely. So with all these efforts, the drug's entry into the environment has actually slowed. But have we seen a change in the vulture populations now?
So that's what's really exciting and has really come out in the last few months. In India, there's been a slowdown in the declines of all of the most gravely affected species, with a slight increase in one species recently reported. Mm-hmm. The same has been happening in Nepal. In Bangladesh, which was the last country to institute the diclofenac ban, the declines have at least slowed. Mm-hmm. And in Pakistan, another of the vulture species is now recovering. So we're just beginning to see, after this catastrophic decline, on average about 99% of the birds gone, we're just starting to see the upturn in the curves.
Wow. So what's the takeaway message from this? At the beginning, you said this is a conservation success story. What are the lessons that can be transferred to other problems or other regions?
I think the big one is that conservation can work, even in really pretty challenging situations. This was an insidious problem on a massive scale across a very large area, and conservation has succeeded in tackling it. Related to that, science in particular can make a real contribution to identifying and resolving these conservation problems and their impacts on human well-being. But a key component here has been that scientists haven't just identified the problem, suggested an answer, and then walked away. They've continued to be involved in testing and monitoring the solutions that they can come up with and improving them and trying to detect what else can be done to deliver solutions. And that's something that continued monitoring and refinement, adaptive management, if you like, is something that's widespread in medicine, in engineering, and so on. It's rarer, I think, in conservation, but it's clearly been very important here. The last thing, I think, is that communication has been central here between the NGOs, the academics, the governments, and the openness of that communication has been pivotal, I think, to governments giving this the strong backing that it needed.
Great. Well, Andrew Bomford, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Andrew Bomford is the author of a perspective about resuscitating vulture populations in this week's Science.
While political systems debate the existence of climate change, scientists are getting to work preparing for the consequences. And in countries like China that rely heavily on high yields of grains like wheat and rice, understanding the impacts of a warming climate is vital for sustaining a growing population in years to come. After a recent visit to China, science contributor Christina Larson spoke with me about some of its efforts to sustain agricultural outputs as temperatures go up and water levels go down.
I visited some Chinese scientists who are trying to project the impacts of climate change across the whole of a very large and geographically diverse country to try to add up all these different environmental factors that will be affected by climate change. So one thing that they're doing in particular is studying the impacts of elevated temperatures at all the various stages of the plant growth. So for instance, in southern China, elevated daytime temperatures may on average be beneficial to rice crops, but if the temperature spikes above 37 degrees Celsius during the pollination phase, it could render the pollen infertile and have a very negative impact on yields. Another thing that they're doing is analyzing past yield and meteorological records across China to try to isolate the impact of the climate signal.
Right. Now, China is a huge country, and it's growing. So, climate aside, what pressures is it facing as its population grows and its economy continues to develop?
Well, China has about 20% of the world's population, but only 7% of arable land. So it's already starting off with an inherited challenge in that way. That amount of land is also shrinking because of rapid urbanization in China. So between 1998 and 2006, China's government estimates that urbanization swallowed up, on average, about 860,000 hectares of arable land each year. At the same time, the demand for grain in China is increasing, and it's increasing not so much because of human population growth, but because of changing dietary habits. So as more people have entered the middle class in China and they have more choices about what things they eat, there's been a growing demand for meat. And that puts more pressure on land and water resources.
Right.
Just to put some numbers to this, in 1978, China's total meat consumption was just 8 million tons. But by 2012, it had risen to 71 million tons.
And then climate change, of course, can mess up any one of these factors. So let's talk a little bit more now about the researchers that you interviewed. What are some of the main areas of research? What is the focus in moving forward?
The place that I visited with the researchers is a small city called Yusheng. It's in Shandong province. They had set up in an agricultural field station in Yusheng, basically the equivalent of heat lamps in a field. So they were elevating the temperature, I believe it was 1.6 degrees centigrade, to understand how that would impact the different phases of the plant growth. As I mentioned, they're very interested in each stage. One thing they found is that the earlier stages of winter wheat in this region seem to be accelerated. There seems so far to be less impact on the later stages. They're trying to work out what that means for grain yields. The other thing that's relevant in this area, because it's water short, not directly related to the research, but surrounding and relevant to the research, there are various efforts to work out feasible water conservation schemes for agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So one example, it's a partnership between this field station I mentioned and the city government of Yucheng, is that they are starting to charge farmers not based on their overall acreage, as had been done in the past for water usage, but based on actually measuring how much water they're extracting from the irrigation channels. So they've set up these new sensors in the old concrete irrigation channels, and those sensors send real-time data back to computers that the Water Management Bureau has access to. So in other words, you're trying to exactly measure how much water farmers are using for agriculture and then create financial incentives for conservation.
And so much of the uncertainty about climate change is based on the fact that we're not sure exactly how we're responding even now to a changing climate. How does Chinese agriculture appear to have fared over the last century as temperatures have already been increasing?
You raise a very good point, which is that when you're looking at what's happened in terms of yields over the last 30 or 40 years, in trying to isolate the impact of the climate signal, you have to reckon with the fact that so many other things are changing at the same time. For instance, land use, the use of fertilizer, pesticides, and so overall yields have gone up. So what the scientists that I spoke with and others have done is go back through and compare yield records with past meteorological records and try to understand what likely would have happened if the climate had remained stable, and then compare that with what actually is happening. They found that overall across China, wheat and corn yields have declined 1.3% and 1.7% respectively from what they otherwise would be between 1980 and 2000. In other words, yields of wheat and corn are still going up because of all these other factors, but the scientists I interviewed believe that they've gone up less than they otherwise would have because of climate. Another thing that's important, by the way, is that most analysts and scientists think that the benefits that you can have on yield by just putting in more inputs, more fertilizer and pesticide, have about leveled off. So you're not going to see this continued spike in yields going up because of these things. But from a research perspective, it makes it a bit trickier. Now, another estimate that was offered by a different set of scientists working in conjunction with the International Food Policy Research Institute in D.C., they studied 1979 to 2000, and they found a 4.5% decline in what they expected the growth in wheat yields would have been versus what it actually was. So you're seeing a range of estimates, but I think that's because you don't have a sort of a clean slate that you're evaluating. There's so many variables that you're trying to pick out what is and isn't important.
Right. And you mentioned that now farmers in one particular project are being charged differently for the amount of water they used. What are some other potential solutions, some other research areas that might help mitigate these climate risks?
I think the thing that is really attracting a lot of attention is understanding what kinds of different cultivars could thrive in the new climate conditions. So, for example, I also interviewed some people at the USDA's Agricultural Research Center in Ames, Iowa, and also some folks at the Philippines International Rice Research Institute, as well as the Chinese scientists. And there's a lot of similarities in their thinking, although they're focused on different crops, in saying that different cultivars that have slight differences in their behavior can actually make a quite significant difference in yield. So, for example, there's some rice cultivars that release their pollen early in the morning hours when the temperature is generally cooler. So those kinds of cultivars would be less likely at risk to have exposure to the very high temperature during the pollination stage that might render the pollen infertile. So what the scientists are trying to do is map out what kinds of cultivars are naturally available, what kinds they can breed, and these very particular aspects of how climate impacts different phases of the growth stage and, you know, what are the benefits of different kinds of cultivars. IRRI, the International Rice Research Institute, has identified a kind of rice cultivar with greater flood and drought tolerance that they're piloting in some parts of eastern India, where the rice harvests depend on very variable rainfall and not irrigation. So the farmers have actually less control over how much water is available for the crops. And I should say the folks at IRRI were, despite the challenges that they're looking at, seem relatively optimistic that they can deal with a lot of what climate change may present to them. Obviously, other scientists are different spots in the range of optimism and pessimism about how adaptation is possible. But in common, all of the scientists I spoke with are very aware that they will need to be able to understand better the impacts of climate on different kinds of crops in order to recommend adaptation, which they all think is necessary to some extent.
Great. Well, Christina Larson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christina Larson writes about climate change research in China in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So up first, Dave, we have a story on changing weather not due to climate change.
Changing weather due to irrigation. This story has to do with California's Central Valley, which is an area almost twice the size of Massachusetts. And farmers there raise more than 200 different crops. It's actually one of the largest irrigated regions in the world. Every year, several cubic kilometers of water are supplied to the Central Valley's field, and about 60% of it comes from river flow. The rest comes from wells. So there's a lot of water being diverted into these fields. The thing is that not all this water actually nourishes the crops. A lot of it just evaporates. So the question in the study is, where does that water go, and mm-hmm. how is it impacting local regions?
So how do they test such an idea on such a large scale? I mean, you're talking about weather patterns from, you know, evaporated water.
Exactly. So usually when researchers have to sort of figure out what's happening with something as complicated as the weather, they turn to global climate models, which is what they did here. And they had a global climate model. They fed a lot of data into it in terms of, you know, how much water is being pumped into this region, where's the water going, how is it impacting weather patterns. And what they found was really interesting. They found that overall, the water being pumped into California's Central Valley boost summer rainfall in areas like Wyoming, mm-hmm. Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico by 15% above average. And it actually boosts the runoff of the Colorado River by 28%, which could actually cause periodic flooding of the Colorado River. So this irrigation is actually having some pretty important impacts. And what's more, it's not just the water itself. The water vapor in the air, when it condenses, it releases a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. And then this hot air rises. It creates a low pressure at ground level. And this can actually increase storm activity in regions as far away as the Gulf of California and the Gulf of Mexico.
So the evaporated water isn't just raining down. It's actually spawning new weather patterns altogether.
Exactly.
Well, do the researchers think this is happening anywhere else? I mean, California is really big, as you said at the beginning.
Right. Well, in fact, there's other places of the world, India, China, the Great Plains. These are all areas where a lot of area is irrigated and potentially be having similar impacts on the weather systems in those parts of the world.
Really interesting. Next up, we have a story on how human intervention, you know, saving the whales or saving the wolves may not be enough to actually recover an ecosystem.
Well, Sarah, this is a really interesting story because, you know, we often think that, you know, if something's missing from an ecosystem and mm-hmm. the ecosystem is suffering as a result, all we have to do is add that thing back and everything will be hunky-dory. And the case in point here is Yellowstone National Park. A century ago, the wolves there were considered varmints and they were practically exterminated by the 1940s. In fact, they had almost completely vanished. And the ecosystem wasn't doing really well as a result. So in the mid-1990s, scientists started reintroducing wolves to the area. And this new study sort of looks at, you know, did that solve the problem? Is the ecosystem back to where it should be? And it turns out it's not really.
So they have more wolves, but there are other things that are still missing?
Right. Well, what happened was that the absence of the wolf caused this explosion in elk and bison. And so first of all, you had this overpopulation of elk and bison, but actually that had an impact on willows. These elk and bison were munching a lot of willows. The willows were disappearing, and that in turn had an impact on the beavers. Beavers need willows. They eat the willows. They actually build their dams with the willows. And it turns out the willows also need the beavers. When the beavers build the dam, the water level rises, and that helps irrigate the willows, and everybody's happy. Well, it turns out taking the wolves out of this very complicated equation has made everybody unhappy.
So what's the biggest impact that scientists are seeing today? What's missing in the park itself?
Well, the scientists found that even reintroducing the wolves didn't solve the problem. They did some experiments where they actually built their own dams. They fenced off some of the willows, and they found out that the willows were still growing a lot shorter than they should be to be really viable, even with the wolves back in to reduce the populations of elk and the bison. The willows still aren't completely recovering.
So the willows are stunted, and returning them to their former height and glory is going to be difficult. What is there that researchers can do?
Researchers say it's a pretty tough egg to crack. They say perhaps if Yellowstone got a very wet year, that would encourage willow growth. That may be combined with a year that saw a low level of elk browsing, would allow beavers to establish a foothold, and that would increase water levels because they're building more dams. Mm-hmm. The willows start to recover. That helps the beavers, and you sort of have this cycle getting back to where things were originally before the wolves were exterminated. But a lot of stuff has to really happen right for that to happen. But, you know, all this really shows that these ecosystems are very, very complicated. It's not just a case where if you remove something and put that thing back in, all of a sudden you've solved the problem. This study really shows that it takes a lot more than just a simple reintroduction to save an ecosystem.
Great. All right. So last up, we have a story on the potential finding of empathy in birds. What's going on?
Well, so this is actually even a little bit more than empathy. It has to do with something that we've talked about a few times before on the podcast, this theory of mind. And what theory of mind is do I sort of know what you're thinking? So if you raise your hand to me, do I know that, you know, you're going to just high-five me, or do I think that you're going to slap me across the face? And, it sounds kind of silly, but actually this is how we all get along. You know, we don't necessarily read each other's minds, but we have a pretty good idea of each other's intentions, which is sort of a way, maybe a subtle form of mind reading. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether other animals are able to do this or not. And this new study suggests that Eurasian jays, which is a type of bird, are actually able to do this.
And what made them think that Eurasian jays would be a good bird to study for this?
Well, jays are actually known as very intelligent birds. Scientists have shown previously that they can plan for the future, that they have sort of some conception of not just the current moment in time, but future moments. And so they thought this would be a good species to study to see if jays also had maybe this theory of mind. And the experiment they chose was actually kind of neat. It turns out that jays have pretty complicated courtship displays. And when the male jay, Eurasian jay, in this case, is trying to woo a female, he actually feeds her during the courtship display, and he tries to feed her food that she likes. Well, it turns out jays have a preference for certain foods. Given the choice, they prefer mealworm larvae or wax moth larvae, but they kind of get sick of a food if they eat too much of it. So the scientists also knew that when the birds have been fed a lot of wax moth larvae, they tend to switch to the mealworms after a while because they just kind of get tired of the same food over and over again, kind of like we do. And so the researchers set up an experiment where the male could actually watch what the female was eating. So if the female was eating, for example, a lot of wax moth larvae, the male would start feeding her mealworm larvae and vice versa. It was almost as if he was saying, look, I know you're probably getting sick of that. Here's a different kind of food.
And so he doesn't eat himself or give her something that he wants. He gives her what he thinks she wants.
And exactly. And that's the key phrase there. He gives her what he thinks she wants, which is a suggestion that he's actually, in a way, getting inside of her head. He's saying, I'm not just going to give you a bunch of food because I just guess that you're hungry. I'm actually thinking a little bit about, what do you want? What are you getting sick of? Do you want something different? And though it seems sort of like a simple behavior, it's actually very complex, and it suggests perhaps a basic theory of mind that, again, is very rare in the animal kingdom.
But it's really tricky to prove that something else has a mind or that something else is thinking about, right, you know, just judging from their behavior. So is there a way of testing this or teasing it out?
Well, it's a really good question, Sarah. And, you know, again, there's a lot of speculation going on here. You know, we're almost trying to put ourselves in the minds of these birds. Nevertheless, these birds trying to read each other's minds. So it's pretty complicated. This is really obviously hard to study. We can't ask these birds what they're thinking,
right,
or what they think other birds are thinking. So it's experiments like this which at least sort of provide a hint of what might be going on, but we're really not at the point yet where we can actually say definitively that these birds have theory of mind.
Really interesting. So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about how ants use noises to communicate. We usually don't think about ants being noisy. And also a story about how to make bubbles stronger. Hint, it involves zapping them with electricity. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about Japan's controversial scientific whaling. Also a story about how the fight over the federal deficit in the United States is impacting science. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about, are we doing science correctly? Are things like peer review and grants hurting science? Are they helping science? Are prizes helping science or hurting science? Are labs the right size? So are we doing research correctly? And next week, we're going to be at the AAAS meeting in Boston. We're going to be covering breaking news from the meeting. We're also going to be running our Science Lives, but with a twist, our Science Lives will be video chats this time around. So be sure to check out the site. Some of the chats we're planning include a video chat on the future of physics, also a video chat on the downsides of human evolution. So check out the site for video for podcasts, and of course for breaking news from the meeting.
Are you going to be in some of those videos, Dave?
I might. We'll see.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the February 8th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.